This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. For political fans, there was no better place to be than the Statehouse this week as the filing period opened for the first-in-the-nation primary. Among those appearing, Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, Carly Fiorina, and Bernie Sanders. The filing is an important official marker for many campaigns. Here's Democratic contender Martin O'Malley.
Everything prior to this was preseason. But now, with this first debate, we are truly into the competitive aspect of this primary.
In addition to filing in Concord, candidates took the opportunity to travel around the Granite State. Republican Jeb Bush continued his Jeb Can Fix It bus tour. At one stop, Bush spoke at a Manchester charter school about what makes a great leader.
And my guess is one of the great attributes of successful presidents is they're humble. They have humility. They recognize that it's not all about them. It's about having a servant's heart and trying to fix things.
The New Hampshire primary is still 3 months away, but voters did speak in municipal elections this week. New mayors were selected in several cities. Incumbents prevailed in several others. And in Nashua, a familiar face returned to Gate City politics, former mayor Jim Dunches.
We all need to work together to achieve even a greater success for our community. In schools, in commuter rail, in trying to work on the heroin crisis, the downtown housing.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Gary, big news from the Statehouse this week. The Executive Council agreed to let Governor Hassan call the legislature back into special session beginning November 18th. The focus of the special session, Gary, the opioid epidemic, which claimed more than 300 lives in New Hampshire last year, a huge concern for the state on so many levels. Couple questions for you, Gary. First of all, how unusual is it for the governor to call back a special session in the fall?
Well, this is kind of unusual. I mean, it's very unusual, to be honest about it. I mean, there have been rumors about this going floating around for about a month or more. What I think is kind of interesting is she wasn't able to convince Senate President Chuck Morris or House Speaker Sean Jasper to call the legislature back. So she had to go to the Executive Council, where she got a 4-1 vote. Basically, two Republicans joined her somewhat reluctantly and blasting her while they did, saying basically this should have been done a year ago, not now.
So she can go to the legislature or the Executive Council for permission to do this?
She could have gone to she could have convinced the Senate President and the House Speaker to call everybody back. She wouldn't have had to gone to the Executive Council.
Now, part of it is just because there's a little bit of money involved, right, Gary? You have to pay lawmakers for their gas and so forth.
You don't get paid except for a special session. No, I mean, you have to bring everybody back. It's kind of an inconvenience for a lot of people because a lot of people do other things. Surprisingly, they're huge salaries of $100 a year. So it's kind of difficult to get everybody back at any time after the session closes.
Sure, and a lot of these lawmakers have jobs and things that are going on.
Going on, yeah.
Well, and there was some hesitation, too, among Republicans as to whether the timing was right, not just the inconvenience, but also whether calling this special session all of a sudden was the right way to go about it. Here's Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, state senator, worrying about just rushing the process.
If we do it with due diligence, with stakeholder input, with the normal committee process, all of which we were preparing for in January, we're going to be able to address the opioid crisis much better.
So, of course, everyone says, Dean Spiliotis, that politics should not enter this, given the seriousness of the issue. But Gary's right. There was some politicking around this week.
A lot of politicking around this week. If you spend a few minutes on social media, you saw the pitch battle between Democrats and Republicans. Republicans arguing that, you know, this is a kind of an election year, soon to be an election year stunt by Governor Hassan, who's running for Senate. Democrats defending her, saying that, Republicans have not been sufficiently forthcoming in resources. Republicans saying, you know, if Governor Hassan hadn't held off signing the budget, that would have provided some needed funds a little bit earlier. So a real back and forth. I mean, I was almost surprised to see the 4-1 vote in the executive council to go forward with this. Some also say that this is sort of a backdoor attempt to get Medicaid expansion up and discussed in the legislature. But we'll see. You know, the reality is with a special session, majority party gets to set the rules. So the Republicans will have a lot of say how this moves forward, whatever the initial motivation is for calling it. But, you know, if you spend any time listening to the political environment, presidential level, local level, this story of an opioid crisis and heroin addiction and all the tragedies that go along with it really have come to dominate the news. So clearly something's going on. You know, it's inevitable, you know, given the political context, that this would be politicized. But it sounds like they're going to move forward and try to do something.
Despite, Gary, go ahead.
Despite
yeah.
all of the politicization of it, I mean, and it has been fierce, to say the least. I mean, I do think that the governor and the legislative leaders have boasted this has got to be our number one priority now in the special session and in the next session going forward, because it's just such a huge problem. And all of a sudden, I mean, it's sort of like the whole state has coalesced all of a sudden around this issue, because, frankly, it's hard to find families that haven't been touched in communities with
well,
this whole problem.
Sure, and police and public safety and the hospitals and just is just tentacles
pervasive
everywhere.
The question is going to be whether they can agree on a comprehensive package, which is always sort of the ideal thing. But, you know, what we've seen so far is kind of tweaking of existing programs here or there. So we'll see if there's sort of the political will to kind of do something big.
There's some simple things that they can do, such as the change the fentanyl. Right. Penalties to make them the same as heroin. A couple of little things like that that we'll probably see being done. Some of the major issues, they won't be dealing with those until the session starts.
Setting up drug courts. We talked about that on the exchange earlier this week. I want to remind everybody it's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love to hear from you this hour as we cover some of the top stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One or two more questions for you guys on this special session that's coming up very quickly later this month. Dean, you mentioned Medicaid expansion, and I'm glad you did.
Yep.
Remind us how that is tied to this heroin addiction, opioid addiction crisis, and whether it may or may not come up in this special session.
Yeah, well, you know, the bigger issue with Medicaid expansion is it has a provision where it will sunset at the end of 2016. This comes out of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. We've had an initial run of the expansion in which over 40,000 people have signed up. There was a big debate recently in the legislature about whether to include this as part of the budget or treat it as kind of a standalone issue. They decided to put it off and deal with it in January. You know, the issue is that, you know, Medicaid deals with a lot of our most vulnerable populations. There's money in there for, you know, for these kinds of health care issues, for, you know, treatment and recovery services, et cetera. So, you know, the argument among Democrats and certainly Governor Hassan is that extending that program is essential to treating these very vulnerable populations. There's there is some overlap, obviously, between people who need the Medicaid services and people who are struggling with these kinds of addictions.
The governor has been saying that in order to get the expansion of the treatment networks, which really are haven't been developed fully yet with the kind of to deal with the kind of problem that we have. We need to have the security of having this federal money coming in through the drug treatment program so these people can expand what they're doing now. Otherwise, we won't be able – these people aren't going to be expanding.
And the issue with Medicaid expansion in the state has been that after the initial program, the federal dollars dropped down to about 90%. So, you know, there's some argument among Republicans that this will at some point end up being an unfunded mandate, which they want to avoid, and then the state will have to come up with the money to fill that void.
Okay, so the special session, November 18th, it kicks off, so we'll definitely be talking about it in future roundups. Gary, last question on this. So how does this get started? How long does it last?
Well, that's the good question. It starts on the 18th, but from what everybody's saying, that'll be largely an administrative day. They'll come in, they'll set the ground rules. We'll have X amount of time to introduce bills. We'll have X amount of time for public hearings. And then we'll have a 2 or 3 day session where we send them back and forth between the House and the Senate.
Okay.
So
and
it
again,
could be from 2 weeks to a month.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Just as the holidays get started and the presidential candidates are everywhere. So nothing else really going on.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I did want to ask you all about the municipal elections and that this opioid crisis came up in those mayoral elections this week. But first, Dean, a quick political question for you. There's word this week of a possible challenge to U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte from her right flank. Now, who does this come from and why?
Yeah, this is Bill O'Brien, former speaker of the state house. He called a meeting in Concord of conservatives, this sort of conservative group within the Republican caucus in the state legislature. He called a meeting in Concord to discuss whether or not there should be a primary challenge to Kelly Ayotte from the right. We already know that Maggie Hassan is going to challenge Kelly Ayotte for the seat, assuming Kelly Ayotte is the nominee. But there's a feeling among conservatives that Kelly Ayotte has kind of strayed too far to the center, that she has not been true to the kind of conservative Tea Party principles that at least in part put her in office in 2010, which we remember was the big Tea Party year. And so they're just sort of unhappy with how she's positioning herself, some of the positions she's taken in recent years. And so they got together to discuss whether or not there should be a challenge from the right. They didn't come to any agreement. I think this is something they're gonna think about for a while. You know, another key person involved in this is Jack Kimball, who we know is a former candidate for governor, sort of closely associated with the Tea Party as well, former Republican Party chair for a brief time. So we'll see if anything materializes. It really is just it's added pressure on Kelly Ayotte. I think the likelihood that she'll be defeated in a primary is not high, but it makes things more complicated for her in terms of how she presents herself as a candidate and how she expends resources.
Sure, and there was a big full-page ad, I think it was in the Concord Monitor, yeah. Dean, this week from moderate Republicans like Judd Gregg saying, right. You know, Kelly Ayotte is a wonderful senator for New Hampshire.
Yeah. There is a division within the Republican Party in the state, as there is nationally. We're seeing it big time in the presidential race. And I think this is kind of a manifestation of that. And I think a feeling that among conservatives in the state, like Bill O'Brien and like Jack Kimball, who really sort of got political energy out of the Tea Party movement in 2010 when she was elected, that she has kind of strayed from those core principles.
Well, the Manchester mayor's race made news this week. Again, municipal elections on Tuesday around the state. But in Manchester, it was a very close victory for incumbent mayor Ted Gatzis. His challenger, Joyce Craig, lost by just 75 votes, roughly. Here's Manchester mayoral candidate Joyce Craig taking the stage at the Puritan Backroom after unofficial results showed her losing closely. And you can hear supporters in the background chanting, "Recount."
The results tonight were very, very close.
Again, that's Joyce Craig on Tuesday night. And in fact, it turns out she is going to call for a recount. Here's Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis speaking with WMUR's Adam Sexton following his narrow victory on Tuesday night and talking about that recount issue.
My first Senate race, I won by 52 votes. So I understand what it is to be in close elections. So I certainly understand that the city of Manchester tomorrow morning will see me walking back in and doing the things and performing the duties that I have to as mayor.
And if she seeks a recount?
If she seeks a recount, that's up to her.
And again, with more on this recount story is Paul Feeley, City Hall reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Paul Feeley, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Laura. I'm glad to be here.
So give us the latest, if you could, Paul, please, about this recount.
Well, the latest is it will take place, and actually the margin of victory for Mayor Gatsas has widened slightly since the unofficial results came out Tuesday night. Initially, it looked like it was 75 votes. It's grown since then to 85. So she does have a little bit of a, you know, larger margin to make up. But in any case, Joyce Craig did file Thursday afternoon seeking a recount, and the city clerk, Matt Norman, was actively working to schedule it last night. Manchester has a 3-person board of recount, and he was contacting members. And I think as of the end of business yesterday, he had reached 2 of them. It's looking like it will happen Monday, although nothing official has been announced yet.
Sure. So is this unusual in Manchester, Paul?
It is, especially in a mayoral race. As far as I can tell, the last time it happened was in 89, which actually involved another effort by a female candidate to become the first woman elected mayor in Manchester. That did not get out of the primary race, but that was the Emile Beaulieu and Leona Dykstra primary. It was a partisan election in 89. Beaulieu initially won by 56 votes, and by the time the recount was done, he had won by 60.
So hanging chads and dimpled chads and pregnant chads, for those of us who remember the 2000 election in Florida, right there in the Queen City. Well, what does it say, Paul? Put on your analyst hat for a moment, if you could. What does it say that it was so close?
I think it shows that, you know, maybe there were more folks in the city than Mayor Gatsas expected that are looking for a change. After 6 years in office, whether you like the candidate or not, some people feel it's just time to have a new face in there. I think his message in the last month of the campaign really focused on tax cap issues and benefits for local city officials, while while Joyce Craig's campaign was focusing on public safety issues and concerns and the schools' lack of resources. And I think some people out there were ready to give someone a new opportunity. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's a lot of votes to make up.
85, yeah.
I think, and she admits it readily. You know, she knows the odds are stacked against her, but she's giving it a go anyway.
Other aspects of this story, Paul, that you think people should know about before we let you go?
I think it'll be really interesting once we're able to analyze the turnout to see exactly how many Democrats and Republicans came out for the race. I'm particularly interested in looking at Ward 8. Where Gatsas had his largest margin of victory is over 200 points. And yet in that ward, there were Democrats running for the local offices of aldermen and school committeemen, and won both those offices handily. And yet he had his largest margin of victory there. So I'm really interested to see how many from both parties turned out and trying to find out the thoughts behind their votes.
All right. Paul Feeley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Feeley, City Hall reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary Reno, I'd love your thoughts on this very interesting Manchester mayoral race.
Well, it is. And I mean, what I understand is that Gatz has flooded the city with mailers in the last leading up to the election, almost all focusing on taxes, which is always a winning number in Manchester. When you start talking about taxes, you got people's attention. What also is interesting is how this became it's supposedly a nonpartisan race, just much just like Nashua. I know we're going to talk about Nashua a little later, but just like Nashua, both of these races, the political parties were checking in big time, and a lot of money got spent in these races, a lot more than usually does.
So these mayoral races are non-political in name only?
In name only, yes, that is correct.
Yeah, there were mayoral races all over the state, and we will wrap up those in just a moment. There were mayoral results in other cities from Keene to Portsmouth to Berlin. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Your questions, comments, thoughts on some of the top stories of the week, 1-800-892-6477. So coming up, we will look quickly at the mayoral results from other cities, and then we'll look at all the presidential activity in the Granite State Week this week. Boy, there was a lot with the official filing period opening at the State House. All that's coming up. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to mayoral races in other cities, and in a moment, we'll also look at presidential politics. As always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And with us now on some of the other political stories of the week is Dan Barrick, senior editor for politics and policy here at NHPR. And Dan, thank you for taking time out.
Thanks, Laura.
And let's just catch up on some of those other mayoral races. Dan, we talked about Manchester earlier, but in many cities, Tuesday night was a good night for incumbents. Dan, fill us in, please.
It was pretty much down the ballot in the other dozen cities going to the municipal polls. Incumbent mayors won re-election in Concord. Mayor Jim Boulay won a fourth term pretty easily, as he has throughout his mayoral candidacy. A number of the issues in the city, you know, the downtown redevelopment and you know, themes that are common to a lot of cities. But it was a pretty good night for him. In Keene, Berlin, Dover, and Laconia, incumbents all were returned to office. The other big, in addition to Manchester, obviously, the other major contested office, though, the contested mayoral seat was in Nashua, where current Mayor Donnelly Lozo was not running for re-election, which opened it up. Like Manchester, it's officially a nonpartisan election, but there were the two candidates were Jim Donches, a longtime familiar face in Nashua, Democrat. He actually was mayor for a period in the late 80s and early 90s, been a lawyer in town. And Chris Williams, also well-known in the city. He was a longtime chair head of the Greater Nashua Chamber of Commerce. Very, you know, lively race, a fair amount of money spent, some interesting use of social media by Chris Williams, and in some ways a sort of generational race. Donches, you know, obviously has experience going back 25 years. Chris Williams claimed the mantle of the younger generation, but Donches ended up winning that race by a fairly comfortable margin.
Yeah, that is interesting. Gary, did you want to jump in on that Nashua race too?
Well, yeah, I mean, as Dan said, it was being played as like old Nashua and new Nashua, and this is the way it should be. But I think what was very interesting about this race, unlike some others, is after it was over, Chris Williams put this thing up on Facebook, basically a video up saying, "I'm going to help in any way I can. We got to move the city forward," which is a lot different than what we've been seeing in a lot of places.
Yeah, other races that you guys were keeping an eye on, pretty much those are the big ones. Yeah, okay. Well, speaking of politics, Big week in presidential politics. Huge, and we'll try to cover it all. And Dean, I'm going to start with you. The filing period opened at the Secretary of State's house, at the State House. What does this mean for these candidates, Dean, both officially but just also politically? It's an important marker in their campaigns.
Absolutely. You know, we certainly from Wednesday through Friday had a real filing frenzy at the State House, and it was a fun opportunity for people to show up and kind of spontaneously support their candidates. A number of first-tier candidates did press conferences outside at the State House as well. So just kind of a fun sort of festive atmosphere. Literally it means you're signing up to be on the presidential primary ballot. You fill out the paperwork, you pay $1,000. Pretty easy to get on the ballot here in comparison to some other states. The filing regulations are typically set on a state-by-state basis, so it's much harder in other states. So that's kind of the official aspect of it. But the unofficial aspect of it is it's viewed as kind of a sort of a reset or a starting, on your marks, get set, go moment for a lot of these candidates. They want to show that they have a good turnout of supporters. It's one of the great photo ops of every primary, where everybody jammed into the hallway. You know, all of Carly Fiorina's supporters were wearing red. It's just this sort of great optics of a sort of classic New Hampshire primary battle. So, we saw a number of the sort of big candidates sign up. Now, you remember, when you actually go to vote in the primary, you're going to see 20 or 30 names on each ballot. So there are other people lining up to register as well. But we did see kind of sort of the top-tier candidates, Trump and Rubio and Fiorina and O'Malley and Sanders, all signed up. I think Hillary Clinton is going on Monday. So it's just kind of a way to really say, okay, we're in this for real. So for example, one of the things that analysts have said about Donald Trump for a long time is, well, we'll know he's in when he actually signs up to be on the ballot, that he may at some point, if he's not winning, drop out before his name is on the ballot. He came in person, which was a sort of a big moment for, kind of national media covering him and also for his supporters here in the Granite State.
Well, fun time to be at the State House. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Dean's right. I mean, in a sense, it's kind of just an administrative marker and a necessity, but it's also this great embodiment of the cultural aspect of the primary, this tradition of – one of the things I find interesting about it, it's one of the few, if the only times, when all the candidates – they're all sitting in the same chair, not at the same time, but they all have to go through Bill Gardner's office. And he, with his great tradition and control of this operation, he insists that they all sit at a table and spend time answering local media questions. And they're jammed in what is essentially a bureaucratic office. He does not pretty up the space for them. There's boxes and old books and papers stacked everywhere, and his staff is standing on their desks because there's no room on the floor. But it's this great leveling moment for the entire field. And if you go into Bill Gardner's office, you'll see framed photos going back to Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton of everybody doing the same performing the same exercise. So there's something it really captures the role of the primary in the state's history.
Well, I've got an email here from Jack wondering if Bernie Sanders is now a registered Democrat, or is he on the ballot while still an independent? Now, Dan, this was an outstanding question earlier this week.
It was. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been, and one of his claims to prominence is that he's the longest serving independent in the U.S. Congress. He has never run in Vermont. He's never taken the Democratic Party's nomination. So this was, part of the, in addition to paying $1,000, the state law in New Hampshire to get on the ballot requires you to sign a form affirming that I am a registered member of X party. The way that this was resolved, and again, anyone can challenge any candidate's registration. So there may be further steps in this. Bernie Sanders said, in the state of Vermont, you are not required to be a registered member of a party to vote. So his state laws have that, and that he has been put on the ballot in Vermont, the presidential ballot, as a Democrat. So at least by his home state's definition, he's a Democrat. And he brought some local people to vouch for him. So state Democratic Party chairman Ray Buckley, who is by no ways endorsing Sanders, came and accompanied, a very unusual step, accompanied Bernie Sanders to the filing, stood behind him while he signed the papers. And at one moment during the press conference, Senator Sanders turned to Ray and said, "I'm a Democrat." And Ray said, "You are a Democrat." behind the scenes, he had lawyers, campaign lawyers.
Really? Just in case it didn't work out.
Yeah. So, there could be a challenge raised. But Bill Gardner said, "I have no reason to reject his filing." At least by the Sanders campaign's telling, this is a settled issue. And Sanders said, in fact, to a question yesterday, "I'm running as a Democrat, and in future races, I will run as a Democrat."
Well, Jack, thank you for the email. Gary, and then Dean.
Well, I think, it got played up a little bit that Bill Gardner was going to challenge him and all this in the social media and Twitter and so on. And Bill had no intentions of he said, I was going to make up my mind when I saw what he did. And he said, when he signed his paper, just like every other candidate as a Democrat, he said, "Why am I going to challenge this? I'm not going to challenge this. I haven't heard from anything one way or the other." So now if it is challenged, it has to go to the Ballot Law Commission. They've scheduled a meeting for the 24th of November. And this is one issue. The other issue is Ted Cruz, because he is not born on native soil. He was born in Canada. And unlike some others like John McCain, who was born in Panama Canal, it's not – he was not at an army base or a military base or something like that. His family was living in Canada and working there. So that's the next issue to come up.
Ah, that's interesting. I had forgotten about that, Gary. Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, no, we've basically covered it, but the issue was that Gardner ended up saying, yeah, his paperwork looked like everybody else's, and so it's not – he's not going to challenge it, but obviously someone could in theory. And I also was going to mention he caucuses with the Democrats as well in Congress.
Well, there's so many candidates we could talk about, gentlemen, and there were so many in the state this week taking the opportunity to file and then visit the state. state at the same time. Here's Marco Rubio. He toured the state this week. Here he is talking with young professionals at St. Anselm College, citing his youth as an advantage in addressing the pressing issues of the day.
And the world has dramatically changed just in the last 5 years. This is the Industrial Revolution happening every 5 years, not every 50 or 100. And so it is important for us to have leaders that understand this, that understand that you can be a conservative, but you've got to apply those principles to the issues of the 21st century, which involves global competition, rapid changes in innovation, and a need to modernize higher education.
Okay, so Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Dean Spiliotis, said to be gaining traction in New Hampshire. What are some voters starting to like about Senator Rubio?
It's interesting. I've had this conversation for months now. He's been a man on the verge, I think, since July or August. He's sort of the next candidate who's supposed to surge. And there's, a legitimate debate now among analysts about whether or not he is, in fact, surging, or this is just sort of more of the same discussion about he's well-positioned to surge at some point. I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics averages for New Hampshire here, and right now he's in third at almost 11%. Trump's at 27.5% on average. Carson's at 13.8, and Rubio's in third in New Hampshire. So he has moved up in New Hampshire to some extent. He has spent some time here. He has said he's going to spend more time. You know, the issue that people raise with Rubio is, you know, where is he set up to actually win in the early primary states? You know, he's doing well in all the states, but he's typically third or fourth place. So he's got, you know, everything on paper, everything looks good. He's charismatic. People find him as somebody who could probably straddle the kind of the establishment folks and the movement conservative folks. He's had this sort of subplot battle with Jeb Bush, you know, because they're from the same state, and to some extent Bush was his mentor when he was in the state legislature, when Rubio was in the state legislature in Florida. So everything looks like it's moving in the right direction for Rubio. The question's going to be whether or not he's actually going to get there at some point.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jeb Bush. And Dan Barrick, I'll turn to you. NHPR's Jason Moon covered the former Florida governor's bus tour around New Hampshire. What was the theme of this bus tour?
Well, there was no, I mean, the larger theme, this Jeb can fix it, is sort of the new motto of the Bush's campaign. And logistically, it's embodied by his renewed focus on New Hampshire as a place where he really needs to energize his campaign. So he's following a schedule, sort of a traditional New Hampshire primary schedule, lots of events loaded back-to-back, different communities. But he's also really trying to inject a real policy-minded approach. So he went to a charter school in Manchester Wednesday morning and talked about his role in education reform as Florida governor. He met with law enforcement officials in Hillsborough County and talked about his thoughts about the criminal justice system and the federal government's role there. So really trying, I think, to, you know, this has been the subtext of his campaign throughout, but that he is a candidate of ideas and substance and policy, which I think is a not too subtle rebuke to a Rubio candidacy, which is largely built around a sort of generational, Rubio at the same time, they were both in the state Wednesday crossing paths at some point. And whether he's talking about foreign policy or the economy, we heard in the bite you played, Rubio's really, you know, that there's a need to bring a new generational viewpoint to, you know, foreign policy, that out of touch generations. And he sort of, there's a sweeping bipartisan critique there. Are not prepared to confront the challenges facing 21st century America in the world. Same thing on the economy. In his words, you need to understand the rapid pace of technological advance and the role in the economy, but you can do that while still maintaining fidelity to conservative principles. So it's an interesting contrast, and we were able to really see it up close on the ground in New Hampshire this week.
Yeah, and Jason had lots of sound in his piece of Mr. Bush getting very, very detailed.
Quite technical,
and he says, hey, I'm a policy wonk. That's who I am. Quick, Dean.
Exactly along the lines of what you just suggested. He's put himself in a difficult position. On the one hand, coming out of that debate performance on CNBC, he has said he understands. He needs to step up his game. He needs to do better. They've hired, I think, a media consultant to help him with his presentation. But on the other hand, he's also at the same time saying, I am who I am. I'm this policy wonk. So sometimes there's a risk in trying to reinvent yourself. So he kind of needs to figure out sort of, you know, who he's going to be as a candidate. There may not be some other version of him that he can be. And it may actually cause additional problems if he starts trying to sort of take on other personas in the state. But I think the sort of he is who he is probably the safer way to go in terms of getting himself into trouble.
Well, another candidate who was in New Hampshire this week is Rand Paul. He spoke early in the week at UNH, putting himself in the position of being a defender of the U.S. Constitution, critical of his own party. Let's hear from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul.
I've been trying to grow the Republican Party. And I've been trying to grow the Republican Party by saying, you know what, we need to be the defender of the entire Bill of Rights, not just the Second Amendment, but the Fourth Amendment, which says the government can't come in your house or look at your papers without your permission or without a warrant. But we also need to be a defender of the Fifth and Sixth Amendment. The Fifth and Sixth Amendment are about justice.
Again, that's Rand Paul speaking at UNH this week. Getting into, speaking of policy want, getting into some, you know, some media issues there. Dan Barrick, what's been the response to Senator Paul in New Hampshire?
Well, this has been this role of kind of trying to goad his own party into trying new approaches or new policies or, you know, appealing to different audiences is in many ways an approach that brought him to prominence when he first came on the national scene, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. Within New Hampshire, I think a year or two ago, he looked like a man who was very well positioned to do well in New Hampshire in terms of both this kind of messaging, his libertarian background, and obviously his father, Ron Paul, had a relatively successful couple runs at in New Hampshire. That hasn't quite panned out. You know, he's definitely lagging in New Hampshire and nationally. You know, it's obviously you don't want to handicap someone at this point, but I think the size of the field and just the realities of what it takes to campaign for president have sort of caught him a little bit by surprise. And who knows, you know, like Rubio, he could be kind of just drafting enough to take advantage if some of the front runners fall down. And he's certainly spending time in New Hampshire. But, you know, it was interesting to see him talk at UNH about this return to this kind of prodding, trying to play the role of the conscience of the Republican Party.
Sure. Well, just to finish up with the Republicans, and then we should talk quickly about the Democrats. Guys, Dean, real quick, what's the word on the next Republican debate and how it's going to shake out? This has been a big issue given the size of the field.
Yeah, I mean, this has actually made some news in the last 24 hours. The next debate is Tuesday, November 10th in Milwaukee. And this time there are going to be 8 on the main stage using the criteria that the Fox Business Network is using. They have 8 on the main stage. And as a matter of fact, Rand Paul is the 8th of the 8 to make it onto that main stage in terms of polling. So the big news has been that Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, Governor Christie and Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, those two who have been on the main stage have been dropped to the undercard. So we're going to have Christie, Huckabee, Jindal, and Santorum as the earlier undercard debate. Lindsey Graham, who's spent as much time in New Hampshire as anyone, and George Pataki, who's also spent a lot of time, they've been dropped from the debates completely. So they're going to have they're not even going to be in the second tier. So we have a 8-person main event and a 4-person undercard. The news again being that Christie and Huckabee have now dropped to the lower tier, which, you know, if you look at Carly Fiorina's success in that first debate, you know, maybe Christie or Huckabee will have a little more space in that earlier debate to make some news. I don't know. I think having 8 people on the main stage will be an improvement simply because there'll be more opportunity for people to speak.
Interesting. Well, turning to the Democrats briefly, Martin O'Malley also was in that line, Gary, of candidates who filed this week, and he campaigned. What sorts of messages are we hearing from former Maryland Governor O'Malley?
Well, he was actually the first major candidate to file this week. He's like about 8:15 after Bill Gardner opened his office at 8 o'clock. He was actually the second candidate to file, but the first major one. He's sort of returning to kind of issues that where he can really contrast himself with Bernie Sanders, particularly on the gun issues, and with Hillary Clinton on the death penalty issues. He's sort of really positioning himself as this sort of traditional Democrat.
Sure, in the middle or different from those two candidates. Mm-hmm. All right. Dan Barrick, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. That's Dan Barrick, again, senior editor for politics and policy here at NHPR. More Friday New Hampshire News Roundup coming up in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Politico.com. With us now for a look at another major story of the week is Brian Walston, digital reporter for us here at NHPR. Brian, thank you for taking time. We appreciate it.
Sure, Laura. Good morning.
So you covered the debate over the state's rules around prescribing opioids, and we talked earlier about the special session focused on the opioid addiction crisis. Governor Hassan has said, Brian, the rules need to be updated. How come?
Well, these rules aren't – there really aren't any rules. I mean, they're recommendations and they reference other rules. I think the governor is following what other states have done, who have gone and updated their own rules to make it less recommendations and more requirements. I mean, if we look at the 500 or so people who have died since 2014 – for drug-related overdoses, I would. My understanding is between half and three quarters of those involve prescription drugs.
Wow!
And the CDC says there are studies that show that 75% of heroin users first became reliant on prescription drugs. So the idea here is that they want to reduce the number of people with prescription drug addictions, thinking that. I mean, I think there's evidence that shows us that it might reduce the heroin-related deaths down the road.
So what kinds of changes was the governor seeking, Brian?
Well, I think some of the bigger changes involved limitations on doses. One example would be to limit the number of pills that emergency room physicians can give to acute pain patients to 3-day supply. She also wanted to mandate use of the prescription drug monitoring program when any physician, acute, you know, family medicine or pain management specialist, any physician initiates opioid treatment on a patient. There were a number of other elements that she wanted to do, expanded risk assessments, evaluations that a lot of prescribers thought really were not the best examples of what they could do. Now, I think a lot of pain management specialists, people who treat people with opioids regularly and for long terms, do some of this stuff. Most of them do. But acute pain, you know, people, family medicine doctor, somebody comes in, they need some, do you need to go through all of these to initiate a patient, care for a patient, especially if it's someone you've known
and have treated for a long time. So the Board of Medicine, she has these ideas. She brings them to the Board of Medicine. What role does the Board of Medicine play in this? And by the way, Brian, you know, what is the Board of Medicine? You know, who's on it? What kind of power does it have?
Well, you know, every state has a Board of Medicine that basically oversees the training and knowledge that physicians have to make sure that they're practicing up to the latest standards of care. Here in New Hampshire, there's 11 members who are appointed by governor. They serve for 5 years. Most of them are doctors, but there are three public members. There's a representative for surgeons, there's a representative for physician's assistants. So what they do is one of the key things that they do is it license physicians, and they also regulate their behavior. And if there's an if there's a complaint filed against a physician, they investigate and reprimand if necessary.
And from what I understand, Brian, the Board of Medicine adopted some of these ideas from the governor, but definitely not all.
No, they adopted some documentation requirements in the sense of what they what physicians have to advise patients as far as informed consent on the dangers of and risks of opioids. They also need to use a quote-unquote evidence-based assessment tool to determine whether a patient has some risk factors for addiction and abuse.
I see. So checking that out before you make the prescription.
Right.
What happens next, Brian?
Well, the rules, the couple of rules that they did pass, which were, you know, part of the recommendations that the governor wanted, they were in place for 180 days. And over that course of time, the board has agreed to create a working group to work up permanent rules that will go through the traditional rulemaking process, which involves a lot of public input, preliminary drafts. There'll be a lot more discussion about this over in the coming months. Okay. And I think that the goal is to have public discussion in January and the rules in place by April.
Well, Brian, big issue. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
That's NHPR's digital reporter Brian Walston, again, talking about the Board of Medicine and how it ruled on Governor Hassan's proposals concerning prescribing of opioids. The number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Join us as we round up some of the top stories of the past week around the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. And Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, a couple more stories to catch up on. Gary, you had an interesting piece in the Union Leader this week about a new way to fund our roads. What is this all about, Gary?
Well, I don't think it's any secret to too many people that the State Highway Fund, which pays for the highway and bridges in the state, has been steadily declining due to a number of things. Number one, well, I should step back and say the highway fund is largely funded with the gas tax and auto registrations. And as we all know, cars are getting more efficient. We're having hybrid cars, electric cars, natural gas-fired cars, and people are holding on to their cars a lot longer. So these two things are combining to drop the amount of money that is going into the highway fund. We've done a lot of one-time fixes. We sold I-95 over to the Turnpike system and all those sort of things to keep the money coming in there. But we're now at the end of all that. And so everybody knows we have to do something. We passed a 4-cent gas tax a couple years ago, which made a little bit of a dent on it. But a lot of that money in the out years is going for I-93 expansion. So we're still not really dealing with a lot of the road issues.
Well, to the chagrin of some in the western and northern parts of the state, but yeah.
Right. And so we have – this committee was formed this summer, and it was formed in the last legislative session to look at alternative ways to raise money for the highway fund. And one of the members was House Ways and Means Chairman Norman Majors, who came up with this plan called a road usage fee, which essentially uses a base of a car that would get 20 miles per gallon and drive about 13,500 miles a year. And if at that rate, you would get essentially about $150 in gas taxes from that. So if you have a car that's getting 40 miles per gallon, which means that you'd be getting only $75 a year in
gas. So how do you recoup
that
other
$75? So you recoup that up to $150 by charging them the $75 road usage fee.
So you're making people with more fuel-efficient cars pay more.
And Norm tells you that may be, but you still get to keep 90% of the savings that you made from your efficient car, because the only thing that we're recouping is the gas tax part.
Got it. Right. Yeah. Okay. So how's that going to go over, Gary?
Things like this are always very hard to pass the first year. I mean, these are the sort of things that you float out there this year, you try a little bit more again and again and again. And, you know, if you 2 or 3 years down the road, you might see something happen on it. But what's kind of interesting is the leadership in the House didn't tell him. And I mean, he's in the leadership because he's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. He's got to be tied in there. Didn't tell him not to go forward with it. So I think there's people are feeling that we really need to have this discussion.
Well, other states have looked at this, right? I mean, this isn't a totally new, crazy idea.
No, I mean, and what other states have done, like Oregon, is this basically charge people for the miles they drive. And which is a real horror show when you start talking about GPSs that you have to buy and all that sort of thing. This is a little more simple than that and not quite so draconian. And, I think it's people are willing to look at things, and this is one of them that they're willing to look at because everybody knows our roads and bridges are not getting any better right now.
Well, Dean, I know transportation's a favorite topic of yours.
Love talking about transportation. Do a lot of driving each year. This is bound to really irritate people who buy hybrids and electric cars or switch over to natural gas power. I think from a political perspective, the trick may be kind of decoupling it from – at least in terms of how it's presented from the gas tax, because if you need to present it in a way that people who buy these more efficient vehicles don't feel like they're being penalized because they don't use as much gas. If you make it about just, you know, roads, cars wear roads down, and not about, you know, trying to recoup gas tax money, maybe it'll be politically more palatable. But these kinds of user fees are always unpopular, and as Gary mentioned, often take a fair bit of kind of consideration and debate before you eventually maybe get some version of them through. But you know, anything that smacks of penalizing people for buying more efficient cars and moving away from fossil fuels, I think will be politically problematic.
As one person said to me, you know, somebody with a Hummer doesn't pay for this.
let's take some calls, gentlemen. And Ben is in Hudson. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to say, actually, and I'm familiar somewhat with the program that's being discussed now about charging vehicles based on their mileage that they've driven.
Sure.
And one of the other options that they've seen, especially in Oregon, is the option of using scale taxes. So you could actually, lighter cars and even more efficient cars could get brakes based on just being better for the environment. And then heavier vehicles like trucks, which actually do more damage to the roads because of their size and their weight, could get a heavier or a larger amount of tax. So I just wanted to comment that on that also.
Okay, Ben, thank you for calling in. And Gary, final thoughts from you on this, where it's going to go? We should mention the guy proposing it, the state lawmaker, is a Republican.
He's a Republican, right. He's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. I mean, it's very hard to see this passing this year. I mean, I don't think that's going to happen. If it probably do a little better in the House. I mean, it's probably certainly dead on arrival in the Senate, no matter what happens. But it's hard to see anything like this going through this year. It's an election year, let's be honest about it. Mm. And nobody's going to want to pass something like this in an election year.
Well, Ben, thank you for jumping in. And gentlemen, one last fun story. Not that that story wasn't fun, Gary, but one last fun story that I did want to ask you both quickly about. The lighter side of life in New Hampshire. Lots of bird lovers in the Granite State. And Dean Spiliotis, yeah. Some were very excited this week. Snowy owls in New Hampshire.
Yeah, snowy spotted owl. There were
beautiful
this
birds.
This is a rare owl. You know, we have lots of owls in New Hampshire, but this particular one is rare. Two sightings reported on Halloween, one in Hampton and then one up in Enfield. So, you know, and apparently not an expert on owls, but my understanding is that, you know, sort of how many show up is often a function of kind of the rodent population and the prey population. And it was interesting. For a variety of reasons, I remember that 2013 was a really sort of a bumper crop of rodents. A lot of people struggling with, you know, mice and stuff in their attics and whatnot. And that was actually a big year for owls because they're all, you know, there's a lot of prey available. So it's interesting to understand how the cycle works. But, yeah, I mean, people who you know, love bird watching and doing this kind of stuff, they were pretty excited about this.
Well, on Halloween, though, I wonder if that makes it a sighting suspect. I'm not sure, but that's great. Well, and I always love to end the roundup with a look at what you guys will be covering next week. And Gary Reno, I'm thinking you're going to be very busy in the month of November.
I'm going to be glued to the State House next week.
Sure.
We have
put
more
a cot out back for you, though.
More and more presidential candidates are coming in. We start off Monday with a bang with Hillary Clinton coming in, and it just keeps going on as the week goes on. I know we have a couple of days. We have two or three candidates coming in.
Yeah, and John Kasich, governor of Ohio,
is in today, and it says Chris Christie.
Chris Christie, okay, and then yeah. Hillary Clinton on Monday, and then you'll be getting ready for that special session, Gary.
And then the special session will be coming up the week after that on the 18th. So it's going to be a busy place. We used to have a little quiet time in the State House about this time of year, but it doesn't seem to be happening anymore, so it's always something going on.
Yeah, and then in December, the bills start getting filed, right, for the next session?
Actually, we're starting to see some of those come out now. There are quite a few. Well, there were about 800. We'll probably get up to around 1,000, although today, I think, is the last day that the Senate can file, so we'll have a good idea of how many bills we'll have to deal with next session at the end of the day today.
And I shouldn't say next session. I should say the second half of the session, right? It's a two-year session, so this is the second. the second part of it, a time, Gary, when often bills not dealing with financial issues are filed. This is the time when you often see, you know, social issues crop up.
This is the time for the hot button issues. This is when we have the let's put somebody on record coming up with the election coming up in the next fall. And so we see a lot of that going on. And, I mean, we have the added politicization of having the governor running for the U.S. Senate. So it would be very hard to see how much of what she wants is going to go forward with the Republican legislature. And it's going to be obviously much of what the Republican legislature wants. She's not going to let go forward either. So it'll probably be a pretty good stalemate in the next
year.
All
right. Well, Dean, how about you?
Yeah,
Lots going on.
There's just so much going on. The filing period is always fascinating. It's a great tradition. The size of the Republican field is really kind of adding additional sort of national visibility to it. And then just the politics. There's so much going on at the state level, you know, not only in terms of the special session, but, you know, now this issue of whether Kelly Ayotte's going to be challenged from the right. We've got additional people. Mark Connolly that just got into the governor's race on the Democratic side.
Right. We haven't mentioned that.
Yeah. I think it was Jack Flanagan stepped down as majority leader. He may run against Annie Custer as a Republican in the first congressional district. So there's just this amazing kind of cascading or domino effect politically in the state as people really start to get serious about figuring out what they want to do in 2016. And, you know, it's been ramping up. And I think this next week is going to be no exception.
And, Dean, you did a great job explaining the shakeout in that upcoming Republican debate. Sort of 8 candidates on the A list, 4 on the B list, a couple bumped out completely. Yeah. The Democrats have a debate coming up.
That's next Saturday night, the 14th. That's going to be a totally that's in Iowa at Drake University. That's a totally different scene. That's just going to be three people. It's going to be Clinton, Sanders, and O'Malley. And I think it'll really be O'Malley's biggest chance finally to see if he can kind of get some traction and pull himself up a little even with the other two.
Okay. Well, Dean, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Sure thing, Laura. My pleasure.
Gary, thank you also.
Oh, my pleasure, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.